Are you recording?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm permanently worried now that people who meet me and then look up my podcast will the first thing they'll hear is that I voted Leave, which still carries, I'm not embarrassed, but it still carries with it a certain stigma, let's say, among my metropolitan elite buddies.
I mean, yeah, but you should be carrying that banner proudly, surely, right? You have no regrets, right?
No regrets.
Come on, introduce the podcast.
I don't regret it. I'm just saying, you know, it's a fucking hazard. Like career hazard, social hazard. People assume things, you know.
Are you backing out of this?
I'm not backing out. I'm still doing it. Okay. So anyway, hello and welcome to the Rights Honourable podcast, screaming into your internet echo chamber one painful episode at a time with long drop intros as well. I'm Jimmy, and I voted to leave the EU in 2016.
And I'm Jazza, and I'm thoroughly pissed off that there is now an even lower chance of us winning the Eurovision Song Contest than there was before the vote.
I mean, you can't get much lower than, you know, like...
I felt so sorry for Lucy Jones this year. She had a belter of a song, she's got an amazing voice, the staging was beautiful, all of those mirrors, the pyrotechnics, it was glorious, and she was halfway down the right hand side of the table. She should have been top five.
Yeah.
Anyway, what do we do on this podcast?
On this podcast, we talk about current events, social issues, and all things political.
Oh, yes, it's very good, isn't it fun?
Very good. And we have, as per usual, three topics. The first thing that we are going to be discussing is the Tory version of Momentum, which is the kind of Jeremy Corbyn backing group that introduced itself into the Labour Party and then spread as some form of cancer, eventually overtaking the entire body and not killing it. But, you know, it's been a near-run thing.
Some may say making it even stronger. It was actually more like a mutation from, like, the X-Men universe.
A beneficial mutation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like the Hulk virus, but red.
Mm.
I like my metaphor a lot. You don't have to.
So anyway, Jazza, why is it this Tory group called Activate?
Which is a brilliant name.
It's brilliant now.
Oh, it's brilliant.
Is it better than Momentum, do you reckon?
No. well, I kind of love the juxtaposition between the two names, because Momentum is like, there's something here, let's go. Whereas Activate is like, nah, mate. Like, we've been stagnant
Activate
for years.
Activate does imply dormancy.
Yeah. Let's wake these people up.
It's probably true.
So Activate have been kind of trying to activate. they've got a couple of hundred Twitter followers. They're trying really hard to kind of make the Tory party sexy again.
For young people.
For the youth, indeed. Yeah. But it turns out that a few of the leaders of Activate, a few of the people who have helped found the group...
they don't know that they're founders, but they are early members.
Yeah, early members of the group. They have had a WhatsApp conversation screenshotted and released on Guido Fawkes, where they suggest that one gasses all of one's chavs and uses them for experiments and the like.
Mm.
So lovely. Don't ever say that young Tories aren't normal.
Just a bit of social cleansing.
Yeah, as one does, you know.
Obviously. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, we will be discussing more on that, and if, you know, young Tories are in fact
evil.
Real, yeah.
Pretty much.
Let's not be dicks. Like, there's lovely...
Let's be dicks later.
Okay, yeah, we'll be dicks later.
So for our second topic, we are going to be looking at the announcement that Kezia Dugdale
sounds like a, like, Toyota Kezia.
All right, I'm bad at names. So Kezia Dugdale, the now former leader of Scottish Labour, has stepped down. There's been a lot of resignations. It's hard to keep track of.
It is very, very difficult. It's almost like late May 2015 again, isn't it?
It is.
When everybody resigned.
Peak resign.
Mm-hmm.
But she stepped down, and in stepping down, she's revealed that her belonging to a same-sex relationship.
Belonging to.
I phrased that very weirdly.
You did. Yeah. So the Fabian Society. The Fabian Review. Not the Society. Released a story where they accidentally outed her as being in, not with or whatever.
With,
what did
longing,
you
yeah against,
around
prepositions.
A same sex relationship. This was apparently something that Ms. Dugdale didn't like to be talked about in the first, and it kind of publicly outed her before she was willing to do so herself.
There were allegedly from Dugdale, late night phone calls to people who weren't previously aware that she was in a same-sex relationship mm-hmm. the night before publication.
Mm-hmm.
So
orcs.
Orcs, mm-hmm. super orcs. So we're going to be discussing that more generally.
Yeah, like journalistic obligations,
integrity.
Journalists are never have integrity, Jimmy. You should know this as one.
That will be more or less my position.
Yeah.
And lastly, we're going to be discussing this essay that appeared on Aereo, not sure how to pronounce it, which is a commentary website on politics and all of that good stuff.
Is it basically Breitbart, but for intellectuals? Is it just a blog? Would this have been a blogger in like 2004?
It's a glorified blog.
Okay,
but,
cool.
You know, isn't that basically what a newspaper is anyway?
Actually, truth.
So anyway, this essay, which is called The Manifesto Against Enemies of Modernity, is kind of what it says on the tin, I suppose. It's these two authors have set themselves up as defenders of Western civilization,
yeah.
The rule of law, human rights, democracy, reason, all that good stuff. And
mm-hmm.
they're busy slagging off the far right and the far left, saying that they are lunatic extremists on the fringes who represent nobody.
Mm. Dun, dun, dun. And we're going to chat about the implications of that, because they talk about the pre-modernists as the far right
mm-hmm.
and the post-modernists in a new sense, not the traditional sense, as the far left.
Yeah.
And Jimmy and I kind of think that we occupy both of those. Well,
I think
we've got our toes dipped in either side
yeah.
of this bridge.
Yeah, I mean, we'll discuss this in more depth, but my basic thing is that we are...
That he's a fascist.
Is that... I'm not going to respond to that. me and Jennifer are mostly centrists who agree about 80, 90% of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's
yeah.
a 10, 20% thing
where I want to rip
where,
your job
you know,
little
we are variously
yeah.
communists
yeah.
and fascists, or depending on your mileage,
yeah,
basically.
Exactly.
So, that's fun.
Let's listen to some music.
And hear about Patreon.
Ooh!
Spoiler?
I mean, they'll know now, right? Hey guys, Jazza here. Just quickly to remind you that we have a Patreon. It kind of helps for us because we sink a lot of our own cash into producing this podcast for you every week. It's essentially a way for you guys to give us a little tip, buy us a pint, buy us a coffee, that kind of equivalent. There's loads of tiers of what they call rewards. It makes it very exciting. We have a $4 per episode reward. That means that you get a shout out in each episode, and we have two people who are in that tier. That is Dominique and Matt. Hi Dominique and Matt. You're both lovely, thank you. If you would also like to perhaps become one of our patrons and get access to the Patreon feed and all that lovely stuff, then please search for Right Dishonourable on Patreon, or you can go to the link in the show notes. Right, on with the show. This one's particularly good, I think. Jimmy and I have lots of banter.
So Jazza, how evil are young Tories?
I have friends who are young Tories.
How evil are they? On a scale of, say, 1 to 10.
I love them, but they are generally evil. And I don't think that they will mind me saying that.
You mean they enjoy being evil?
Yeah, 100%. There is a pragmatism to being an older Tory. So I feel like when you get to like our age, around like late 20s, you're around
this
late 20s.
Outrageous.
Around late 20s. Then you're
kind of, you're beginning to accrue wealth in your life, you're doing rather well for yourself. You see the taxes that are taken away from you as a burden rather than you giving back to the world in some way, shape or form. That, I think, is a natural progression to becoming a Tory. But if you're, like, becoming politically conscious and your initial idea of the world is, you know what we need, keep it exactly the same, then I think there's probably something a little bit wrong with you. No?
Yeah, I'm just trying to... There's a lot to process there.
Oh, sorry.
I mean, you're kind of just... I don't know, actually. Are you saying that most of the Tories you know are doing it purely for self-interested reasons? Young Tories, at least.
No, I think some of them genuinely... So I think they're split between people who are tactically Tories and people who are basically ideologues, who really buy into ideologies of, like, libertarianism or anti-European sentiment and didn't want to join UKIP. That kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the only Tories I know are... people I know in finance. Sorry, the only young people that I know who are Tories are in finance, and they're fairly unashamed about the whole thing. And there's actually one guy I know who is, like, from a pretty conservative family and is, like, temperamentally quite conservative, but sort of in a soft way. But he's actually stopped voting for them because of their Brexit stance, which is kind of interesting. But
but my best friend is Tory. Because he would, like, runs a family business.
Am I not your best friend?
No.
Fuck you, guy.
You haven't known me since I was in primary school.
Oh, you know, that's cheap. That's fine. But I mean, I guess one of the points about this Activate group is that the Tories have a problem with young people, don't they? They don't get the youth vote out. There was this research from YouGov shortly after the general election, which indicated in people aged 18 to 24, only 20% of them voted Tory.
Yeah, and 19%.
19%.
Which is crazy, yeah.
That's the lowest bracket. And it's about 60% of people between the age of 18 and 24 voted for Labour. If you're cynical about it, presumably for the tuition fees, pledge, non-pledge thing.
Yeah, I mean, Labour still get over half of the vote with everybody up until the age of 40.
Yeah.
And then are still the people that get the largest number of votes. The Conservative does. This basically means that the Conservatives, if they can't activate some kind of a base, then they will end up dying out with the people that vote for them, right?
It depends how much you believe that people will naturally start shifting over to the Tories as they get older and accrue more wealth and stuff, as you mentioned. I think the main problem with the Activate group, aside from the nasty stuff that they post in that WhatsApp group, which we're going to discuss in a moment, but it's that the whole idea behind Momentum was that Labour had drifted into this kind of Blairite no man's land where they were advocating
the dreaded centre.
Yeah, as in they were advocating status quo policies that have been implemented since 97, firstly under Blair, then Brown, then Cameron. And there wasn't really... Labour had kind of lost its sense of purpose, even if it was still a viable party in many respects. And the whole group around Jeremy Corbyn and a return to kind of purist socialism and that sort of thing, there was kind of an impetus around that. Whereas with this Activate group, I don't really see what the ideological point of it is. I mean, I see that the Tories need to get more young people to vote for them, but beyond that, I don't really know.
Yeah, and I don't think that they know either, because I think that... So the majority of these... I'm going to call them kids, but they are young adults. The majority of these kids are going to be people who are drawn to student politics. And people who are drawn to student politics tend to be attracted to it for like a variety of reasons. But I think that the left tends to attract more because of that. I kind of talked about it earlier, the desire to change something that is inherent in society. So be that Palestine, or be that gay marriage, or whatever the campaign is. Whereas I don't think that conservatives tend to campaign in the same way, or people on the right tend to campaign in the same way as people on the left. And so their ability to suck in young activists is a lot more difficult. And maybe this is kind of a way of trying to you know, get some young boots on the ground.
It's not entirely clear how much Tory party involvement there is.
There doesn't seem to be much at all.
There was one. You have to be a member of the Tories to join Activate. Mm-hmm. But somebody from the Guardian phoned up a bunch of Tory MPs and officials and stuff, and couldn't find anyone who backed the group or appeared to have any official link with them.
Do you think that this is deliberate? Since
well, there's a backstory to this which we should probably mention, which is that during the 2015 election there was this campaign called Road Trip, which had the kind of infamous battle bus, and they sort of bus like young Tory campaigners around the country to campaign.
Which is a standard thing that political parties do.
It's not. I think Labour and the Lib Dems had similar things. Mm-hmm. But what ended up happening with Road Trip is it became mired in scandals, like particularly with, there were allegations of sort of sexual misconduct, particularly from this one guy who's known as the Tatler Tory, this guy called Mark Clark, who was also alleged to have bullied somebody into committing suicide. Mm-hmm. This guy called Elliot Johnson. And then after that, there were various recriminations, and they shut down the Tory youth wing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, presumably Activate is kind of...
New Tory youth wing.
Yeah, basically.
The battle bus was organised by Conservative HQ, right? Whereas there doesn't seem to be any evidence that Activate is the same, right?
Yeah, not currently. There might be the argument that they're deliberately being a bit hands-off with it because they want to see how the Tory party want to see how it's going to turn out.
Yeah,
to make sure
and
it
hasn't
doesn't...
turned out very well.
Yeah, thus far. Do you want to read out some of the quotes in this WhatsApp messaging group that involve members of Activate?
I will say some of the... So they have the numbers and the names blurred out from this WhatsApp group. Some of them aren't blurred out very well. So we might call a couple of them later, make some content. So one person suggests that... we should gas all of the spice homo chav. I don't think that that's gay chav. I think he's calling it like homo sapien.
Yeah, that's what I
was like, is that a gay slur? No, he's just using Latin. Go run some medical experiments on them. We can use them as substitutes for animals when testing. Somebody uses the word chavicide, suggests turning the Isle of Wight into a prison. We can just introduce compulsory birth control on chavs. I will say also, who uses chavs anymore?
Do people not talk about chavs anymore?
I don't think so. I haven't heard the word chavs used unironically since about 2011.
I suppose I haven't either.
Yeah.
I don't really know.
It's almost like they're living in the past. I will say, though, later, like, Guido seems uncharacteristically even-handed with this. He's also posted some excerpts from people who are clearly like those in charge, and have slapped those on the wrists who have suggested gassing all of the poor people.
It says there's a statement from an official Activate spokesperson who talks about, who says that we're going to remove these people from our group and make sure that they're not part of it anymore. But if this is what happens, you know, within the first couple of weeks of you launching your group, it doesn't really suggest good things.
It doesn't, but I do feel sorry for some of these young Tories who have good intentions. Like, they just think, I feel like they see a lot of the same problems in the world that we do, but they think that there are different ways of going about it. And I'm talking about them as if they're a different species. They're clearly not. But, like, for example, one person posts back in this group in response to all of these ridiculous posts. Can I just also stress that the whole point of being a politician is to ensure that the lives of people living in the UK are secured and made better? We don't take the mickey out of the poor. In fact, we could today have all the money in the world, but tomorrow that money isn't promised. Like, I think that is a really good idea. Like, that's somebody who seems to be in politics for the right reasons and isn't just using the bravado to kind of like get cool points.
I mean, I don't think you get cool points for being part of the Tories.
No, but within this group, of course they do.
Oh, what you mean, like making jokes about chavs?
Yeah, they get cool points.
Yeah,
exactly.
No, I see what you mean.
How do you think? So Owen Jones made a video about this, and was outraged.
He's an outraged man.
So uncharacteristic of him. And he suggested that if this were to happen in Momentum, then Jeremy Corbyn would be held personally responsible. Jeremy Corbyn would be forced to make a statement at the very least. Mm. If these kinds of things were in a Momentum kind of like chat group. Why do you think that that isn't the case for the Conservatives?
Well, because the Activate group has no official affiliation to any particular Tory politician, whereas Momentum was explicitly set up as a pro-Jeremy Corbyn group. In fact, before it rebranded itself as Momentum, it had a name that referenced Jeremy Corbyn.
What was it called?
I can't remember what it was, but...
Corbynite.
I don't know. It was an explicitly pro-Corbyn campaign. It wasn't, you know... I'm not saying that Jeremy Corbyn has like a remit over that group, but they were clearly his guys in the broad sense. And I haven't seen the Jones video, but presumably he's referencing directly or indirectly the anti-Semitism accusations hit the far left, which are well founded, to be honest. There's videos online of far left activists within Momentum and within the Labour Party making explicitly anti-Semitic statements. Mm-hmm. And there's this Labour MP who is affiliated to that wing of the party, John McDonnell, that sort of thing. This lady called Naz Shah, I think her name is, and she's posted some revolting stuff that had it been a UKIP member, the shit would have hit the fan. I think some Tories have actually probably got away with similar things. But, you know, there's a nastiness within Momentum that is equal to the nastiness that we've seen in this Activate group.
Do you think that this is representative of what happens when young people get riled up about politics and they don't really know how to behave yet? Am I being patronising as someone in their late 20s?
I don't know, because there might be members in that group that are like pretty much our age rather than 18 to 24.
I think the cutoff for young Tories was 40.
Wow. Yeah. Well, the average age of a Tory member is like 50 or 60 isn't it? Yeah.
I think you get it with your pension now. A Tory
member. That's a good idea. Follow through on that. I don't know. I mean, if you're being super fucking generous to these Activate members who are making jokes about chavs, they probably don't mean them really. Mm-hmm. Like, it might be indicative of some underlying classist views within them, or it might just be them taking the piss. Mm-hmm. You know, people sometimes joke about things and don't mean exactly what they say. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't really come very well across in text. Mm-hmm. So,
I'm not sure it would come much better if it were said, but yeah, no,
it's more obvious when you're being ironic when you're speaking.
I do kind of worry about the kind of like words of political activists when they're an awful lot younger, because I think that people get enticed into particular causes, and then like you are impressionable and you do get very much, and I think that people should be given a chance to grow and to realise that joking about Nazis and gassing people is probably not the way to go, and some people are stupid and do that, and I think perhaps we should be a bit more forgiving in the grand scheme of things. If you're like an old politician from like southwest of England and you use the N-word, however, I feel like you're pretty much made as a human being and you should be held responsible for your actions.
So what's the cut-off point then? Like, I mean...
I'm not sure. I don't think there is one.
These Activate activists said...
Activistas.
Yay. Anyway, these people made these comments like last week.
Yeah.
How long do they need until they have like until they're rehabilitated?
I don't know.
Is there a statute of limitations on these comments?
That would be nice. But I feel like even though like I'm literally reading one of the people's poorly blurred out names now, if they remain anonymous, and then like they come back as like an MP or something and somebody finds out that it was them who said this, then perhaps they should have to... I think that they should have to answer for their younger selves, but they should have been allowed to change their views. Although I will say I'm a hypocrite because I've always held the Bullingdon Club against David Cameron,
George Osborne,
and Boris Johnson.
Yeah,
and I've always been like, no, if you do that as like a teenager, then you're probably a cunt.
I have to say, in opposition to your pretty generous view, or like not generous about the Bullingdon Club, I think that by the time people... I mean, I suppose people do change, but do people change that fundamentally between the ages of 20 and 50?
But I feel like they... I don't think they're... Nobody in that WhatsApp group actually wants to gas chavs, do they? Like, they're just...
Who knows, man? Maybe one or two.
I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt, and I feel like they're just... They're using banter, they're using... it's toxic masculinity at its worst. It's people throwing their micro-penises around. And it's... I understand what young lads especially are like.
I have to admit, I've definitely made jokes just as offensive as that. Uh-huh. Although I'm not running...
It's very generous of you. Running... I never have, because I'm a really good guy.
All right, well, we'll move on from that as a statement. But, I mean, I think, fucking hell, most young men have made jokes that offensive before,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
I assume.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm just a really bad person.
In what they feel is, for want of a better word, a safe space, right? Like, they think that they're out on the pub with their mates, or in they're in a WhatsApp group with their mates, and you act a certain way, you act a different way to how you would if you're, like, public-facing. And what these kids have... done is they've acted as if they're in one of their safe spaces rather than as if they're in the official Activate WhatsApp group.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, this is...
I kind of feel sorry for them now. I've convinced myself.
I don't know.
Forgive it all.
I don't feel that sorry for them, as it goes. No. But, you know. Do you have anything more to say?
No.
No.
So, why should we care about Kezia Dugdale leaving the Labour Party?
I think... there's 2 points here. There's the bit about her leadership and the bit about her being outed against her will.
Yeah.
And on her leadership, I think she had a pretty tough tenure as leader of Scottish Labour. I think Scottish Labour is going through, obviously, a pretty difficult period with the, you know, being outflanked by the Tories.
Least, yeah.
I think their whole, like, remit, their whole, what they're selling is difficult given the stance of the positioning of the SNP, which is... it's a pro-independence vehicle, but it's also one that largely brands itself as being centre-left, which mm-hmm. is normally where Labour would sit. Mm-hmm. And you can argue about how fair that is, like, in terms of their actual policies, but that's, I think, where people see them as being situated.
But to be fair, Dugdale kind of saw the layout of the political landscape. She sees the SNP as the party of... the party of an independent Scotland. The Tories have very much positioned themselves as the party of staying as part of
the unionist party.
Labour kind of had to be a party for all of those people, so kind of had to shrug its shoulders at the question of independence. And Kezia, I think, from what I understand of the campaigning, she decided to plonk herself firmly to the left of the SNP and be like, yeah, I think that richer people should pay more tax. Scotland is a lot more fiscally conservative than you would necessarily give it credit for. They don't like being taxed nearly as much as maybe us south of the border think they do.
Well, I mean, broadly speaking, Scottish and English people have the same political opinions, mm-hmm. roughly. There's a few broad trends. I mean, I guess you might say that Scotland is economically slightly to the left of mm-hmm. England, but...
I'd also love for London to be independent, so...
Yeah. Mm. I mean, I guess London and Scotland are probably...
Yeah.
I mean, if anything, London's probably... Because it's more multicultural than mm-hmm. Scotland and all the rest of it. But mm-hmm. That's by the by. I mean... This point that she made about being outed against her will is quite an interesting one, given the prevalence of actually LGBT leaders, political leaders in Scottish politics, and also the general state that LGBT rights are in
the
UK. Yeah,
before she stepped down, I believe it was 3 of the 5 major parties in Scotland had either a bi or a gay leader. Yeah. So there's Ruth Davidson for the Conservatives, who's married to her wife. Kezia Dugdale, who's in a relationship with a Scottish National Party MSP. And the Green Party leader.
The Green guy, right?
Who's bi.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and then there's Kezia Dugdale, who was in a same-sex relationship. Have I mentioned
them
twice?
I think you've named someone twice. So it's like,
Rooftop.
Oh, no. And then UKIP. The UKIP leader is also
okay.
So 4 out of 6, sorry.
Does UKIP have its own Scottish leader?
It does, yeah.
Fucking hell. That party. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it's obviously... I think that's pretty good in general.
Well, it's very generous of you to say, Jimmy.
It says good things about the general sense of LGBT tolerance in Scotland and the UK, is what I'm saying. And in that sense, it's almost peculiar that Dugdale is complaining about being outed, although she has other reasons for doing so.
So I'm in two minds here. I think I know what where you're going to land on this. I think that you think that the private lives of somebody in public life, that is viable news. It's fair to report, in general, I think it's fair game.
Yeah. Uh-huh. There's caveats to that.
I'm assuming drawing line at children and stuff like that.
Yeah, there's a general agreement, which I think it's codified in the editor's code of conduct, which says that you don't really report on like politicians' children. If a politician agrees to do a photo shoot that includes their kids or something like that, then mm-hmm. yeah, you can do that. But generally speaking, the privacy of kids is respected. There wasn't a particular public interest, I think, in revealing that Dugdale was in a same-sex relationship.
Yeah, it did seem to... Well, because there were so many other out leaders north of the border, everybody kind of greeted it with a bit of a shrug.
As Dugdale herself admits, there was way more interest in the fact that she was dating somebody from the SNP than the fact that she was dating a lady.
Mm-hmm.
I do have a problem with her stance in as much as, this is coming from a journalist, but people generally speaking are really fucking stupid when they speak to journalists, and they do not appreciate that anything that you say to a journalist might well end up in print. That is like that's just a base level fact.
But what if you say that something's off the record?
Well, that's the point. You have to say something's off the record.
And for it to be off the
record. And I've just been, I suppose, like a professional pet peeve of mine, but I've been to conferences where people have been speaking and there have been journalists in the room, and then just suddenly they'll go, oh, by the way, I hope there's no journalists in the room. This is off the record. And it's like, if you do not want a particular view or a particular piece of information attributed to you or in public, do not fucking say it in front of journalists. And that actually...
Yeah, but you don't all wear like high-vis jackets. We don't know where you are all the time.
Well, for the conference thing, I'd say also, if you don't want a piece of information in the public domain...
Yeah, don't say it at a conference.
Do not say it in front of a group of hundreds of your fucking peers, you retard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but... She didn't say these comments were off the record. She just said, Dugdale contends that after she said them, and this is her general policy when being interviewed by journalists, after she said, I'm in a same-sex relationship, she also said, I don't think it matters, please don't report it. The journalist for the Fabian Review says that this never happened. As I said, you can believe one or believe the other.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that neither of them are acting maliciously in this respect, but... Mm-hmm. If she's been saying it to tons and tons of journalists, it's a bit weird that she's surprised that it came out. Just mm-hmm. Apart from anything else, if you know journalists who report on politics, there are certain politicians who are alleged to be in non-straight relationships that you hear rumours about,
mm-hmm.
and the reason you hear rumours about it is because they've spoken to journalists off the record. But as I said, if you tell a journalist something, it might not appear in print if you say it's off the record, but it will get out eventually.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just a fact.
There's a fair few people who, there's rumours about which footballers are in same-sex relationships, even though none of them are publicly out, because like the journalists who are around those people all of the time clearly are not stupid.
Mm.
I am, as I said, I am in two minds about this. I kind of agree with you that broadly, people, especially in politics, quite a lot of your life ends up being fair game.
I think so, yeah.
Especially in the world of free speech that we live in. However, I do think that people who are queer or trans in some way, I think that they should always be able to dictate how and in which manner they come out.
Mm.
Because, so, like, for example, and this is nowhere near the same level as Kezia Dugdale, but my uncle decided to tell my grandparents that I was gay without asking me first. And, frankly, I've never forgiven him. It was 10 years ago. But it's like, I don't think that you should... I think it's very hard to make the case for taking that right away from somebody, because it is a really fucking big deal.
Yeah,
especially
yeah.
if you are like a somebody in the public in public life.
I think I basically agree with you. It's just the I've just emphasized slightly more the dangers of speaking to journalists about anything.
Should never talk to you about anything ever again, Jimmy. Clearly.
Well, no offense, you're not interesting enough to like rat on, or important enough to rat on, I should say. You're probably interesting enough.
Fair. Going back to kind of like, so I feel like we're on the same page about her queerness. What do you think her legacy is as leader? Do you think that there's you're obviously not hugely impressed.
I think she had a difficult job, and you know, as one of our reviewers has previously pointed out, we are not entirely au fait with the intricacies of Scottish politics.
Yeah.
And I think, generally speaking, people should be judged on how difficult the task put before them was and how they performed, rather than just saying, oh, well, Labour aren't doing particularly well, therefore she must have sucked. But I think Labour's position is difficult. I don't think she was a particularly impressive leader. But then I don't really see how Labour can position itself very well so long as the SNP continues to exist.
Mm-hmm. I feel like she is yet another very good example of a woman getting a job when none of the men wanted it and actually not doing too bad a job.
Who were the men that would have contended for it?
Who's the... Here's an example of us not knowing enough about Scottish politics, but who was the leader before Dugdale? He resigned because came out of the 2015 election with a single MP. And then kind of everybody just went, no thanks, I'm all right, I don't want to do this job. And it was Kezia Dugdale against one other guy, and Kezia won it. Kind of as the, like, oh, you candidate? And I feel like she's not necessarily... I don't think that she's necessarily, like, leadership... material.
I remember shortly after she was elected.
But I think
that
she's been a good placeholder.
She appeared on Question Time shortly after she was elected, and she gave this like speech about how she was going to like rouse the troops and all of that, and how she was going to represent Scottish interests, and there was just deafening silence in the audience afterwards, which can happen just, you know, randomly. You know, that doesn't... It's not necessarily a cast iron verdict on her, but I think it is a little bit suggestive. But it might be more suggestive about how Scottish people feel about Labour than it is about how they felt about Dugdale. So,
She seemed very nice.
Yeah.
I hope she's very happy with her SNP lover.
Should we move on?
Yeah. Jimmy, a few days ago you sent me this...
long ass essay.
God, miles long. So why did you send it to me? Give me some background. What's the sitch? What do the listeners need to know?
I feel that listeners who have been following us for a while might have noticed that we differ on a few key points, as Brexit and social justice warriors and free speech and that sort of thing. And as I said, I think broadly speaking, we are actually pretty close politically, but there are obviously some questions that we differ on. And this essay is like... primarily, it's a diatribe from a pair of centrist political writers who are angry that politics is back on the agenda again. In the sense that for a very long time, particularly in British politics, and you can probably argue this for American as well, politics didn't really exist. Like, once Blair had invented his third way. Mm-hmm. That was kind of the only option on the menu. And it's the reason we had uninspiring leaders within the Tory party. It's the reason we had Ed Miliband, and he was received so lukewarmly, because frankly, there just wasn't enough distance between him and Cameron to arouse the passions of Labour activists.
Arouse the passions. Do you not remember the Millie fandom?
I do.
Those were the day. I miss 2015 every day.
Yeah, I can imagine. But, you know, one of the... I'm by no means a fan of Jeremy Corbyn, but one of the things I think is good about him is that he does represent a genuine viewpoint that wasn't represented before he was elected in British politics. And for me, this essay, apart from distilling some of the differences between me and you on certain issues, is kind of like this this cry from people who claim to love democracy, but actually, when it comes down to it, don't really like it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just quite happy with a group of centrists, a group that I think fundamentally is actually quite small, just being in charge and riding roughshod over everyone else.
Mm-hmm. What was also kind of interesting about this is that they talk about the pre-modernists, who are kind of like the extreme right, and the postmodernists, who are kind of the extreme left.
Yes.
And you and I, when we do differ, you tend to fall on the kind of more right-wing...
On the fascist side.
Yeah, on the fascist side. And I land on the identity politics, everybody should shut up side.
So the point about... I actually think their argument about the pre-modern side, of, as they put it, things, is actually far less convincing and cohesive than it is about the postmodern side. But maybe that's because I'm more critical of postmodernists.
Mm-hmm.
But the point that they do make about postmodernists, which is, I think, true, is that there's this kind of... and I've definitely had a go at you for defending this point of view in the round in the past. There's this kind of elevation of subjective experience... among social justice people, and you can tell it particularly in the phrase that when somebody, for instance, like a black activist, gives an opinion about the state of race relations, and then you go, well, hang on a second, if you're a social justice warrior postmodernist, you'll be like, whoa, you're invalidating her experience.
Mm-hmm.
And the choice of phrase there is, and I think this is one of the things that the writers of this manifesto against enemies of modernity do pick out, is that kind of the phrase invalidating your experience, it's not an empirical phrase. It's not saying what you said was empirically and testably wrong. What it's saying is you have argued against somebody's perspective, and for some reason that's negative in and of itself.
So I got frustrated. So I actually, what I have read, I haven't read the whole thing because it is...
It's fucking long.
It's very, very
it's,
long.
It's needlessly long.
Yeah.
It could have been condensed.
Yeah.
Admittedly, they do provide bullet points at the top.
Yeah, but those bullet points at the top are not helpful.
No, they don't summarise the article
that
well.
No, at all. Poorly written, we don't like. But when they would talk about the postmodernists, so the side that I tend to fall on, when it comes to like identity politics and the raising up of voices, all that kind of stuff, I just felt like they didn't get it. Because I feel like that does what you described does happen with political discussions a lot when you're in kind of like left-leaning groups where somebody says you're invalidating their experience. But what I think needs to happen, especially when there are white cis men in the room who are so used to having a voice, and then there are groups of people from other backgrounds whose voices are so rarely heard. I feel like the cis white men, the people with privilege, if you will, should probably do some listening, because there are fewer opportunities to hear those other voices. And to consider them, yes. Criticise them, yes. But actually actually listen to those opinions.
Yeah.
And I think that can be interpreted as a sit down and shut up by people who don't like that methodology, because the people who get annoyed at that kind of behaviour when it comes to raising up of minority voices tend to be the people whose voices then get heard less, because they're used to being the ones talking a lot.
There's a lot of ad hominem there. An awful lot of ad hominem. Firstly, I just reject the idea that there really is such a thing as a black voice or a female voice or whatever, in the sense that black people and women have diverse opinions about things.
Yes, 100%.
So there is not such... I mean, there is no such thing particularly as
But there are certain things that black people, that queer people, that women are going to have opinions of and experience that a white cisgendered man is just never going to understand.
That's true. Yeah, you're not entirely wrong. Mm-hmm. But I think that opinions should be judged on their merits rather mm-hmm. than the person who's actually, who happens to be contributing them mm-hmm. at that particular time. And I also don't really think that there is, there's not such a thing as a white, privately educated, straight male perspective on things. There are mm-hmm. there are views that are more prevalent among people who fit that demographic.
Exactly.
That much is true. Mm-hmm. And you're definitely right that there's certain things that if your experiences and your opinions are at least somewhat based on your demographic, you know, the life you've had. That much is
like our
fucking
opinions
obvious.
On Scottish politics.
Ignorant opinions on Scottish politics.
Yeah. So that I actually read the side that's meant to be representative of me and was quite frustrated with it because it didn't seem to get it very much.
Yeah,
what did you think of the side that is representative of you, the fascists? Basically.
The fascists.
Yeah.
It should be said that since I've been called a fascist several times during the course of this podcast.
I will say, can I just say one thing? Do you watch ContraPoints?
No.
ContraPoints is an anti alt-right channel, and they recently did a video where they talked about like identifying alt-right tendencies in your friends, and I kept on thinking of you even though I know you're not.
Wow.
But I'm just worried that one day you might start slipping down the slope.
it's a perilous slope. one thing that this essay does do, and I suppose this is my complaint against the attack on the pre-moderns, as they're called, is it lumps together people of social conservative opinions, which includes such unsavoury characters as white supremacists, mm-hmm. neo-Nazis, and all those fun guys. It lumps in the social conservatives with libertarians. And there's like historic reasons why those two groups tend to vote more cohesively. I mean, In milder form, those are the groups that actually make up the Republican Party in the US mm-hmm. to a significant degree, and certainly make up the Tory Party in Britain. But libertarians are actually coming, which I guess you'd kind of say that's where I fall, mm-hmm. in as much as I differ from centrists on particular issues. Mm-hmm. They come at it from a massively different point of view. I mean, one of the major things that distinguishes libertarians from, social conservatives is our view on gay marriage, for instance. Mm-hmm. And generally, libertarians are permissive.
And also stuff like marijuana legalization.
Yeah, drugs, sex, rock and roll, all of the good stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm not really sure it makes sense to actually criticize those in the mm-hmm. same bracket because, mm-hmm. Apart from anything else, some of the essay on pre-moderns, I read it, I'm like, trying to criticise this as an intellectual thing doesn't make sense because, no offence to white supremacists, but their ideology is not fucking
I don't think you need to worry about offending the white supremacists, Jimmy. No problem.
Any white supremacists who are listening, I mean this very
sympathetically. Oh my god, leave us a review on iTunes, please.
But I mean, there are like intellectual theories of race, you know, and there have been people, like intellectuals who defended racism, but a lot of social conservatism is fucking guttural. It's like quote unquote common sense. Mm-hmm. It's not thought through. It's not a system of thought.
Yeah.
It's just like a load of base instincts. Some of which are like more or less more justifiable than others, but like, did you see the Vice documentary on the Charlottesville guy?
Yeah.
And this white supremacist.
It was good, actually.
It was an excellent documentary. But the guy that she was talking to, he had ideas about stuff, but it wasn't like, just trying to equivocate between that and postmodern theory just doesn't mm-hmm. make any sense whatsoever. They're not comparable. Like, yeah. Postmodernists are people who, in my opinion, think a bit too much about the world.
Yeah.
And these pre-modernists are people who don't think enough. So critiquing them in the same way, along the same lines, and trying to say this is one side, this is the other, they're both as bad as each other, doesn't really make sense. So I'm mm-hmm. like kind of unconvinced by the essay on those grounds.
I kind of got a little bit of that of, you know, when Trump started calling people the alt left.
Yeah.
And kind of
I should point out the control left is the accepted term. It's not the alt left.
Is it really?
Yeah,
that's actually amazing.
That is a phrase, yeah. Well, it's like the other phrase is, what's it fucking called? Like regressives, like uh-huh. the regressive left, i.e. people who people who want to implement slightly more authoritarian policies in pursuit of what they see as valid social justice goals.
I liked it because it's like alt-control-delete.
That's what they're getting at a little bit more.
Rather than the whole control thing. But people said that Trump, by invoking the alt-left, was drawing equivalency between anti-fascists and fascists, where the people who come out of that comparison best are very clearly the anti-fascists, because they are anti-fascism.
It depends what you mean. Trump was wrong to equivocate between the counter-protesters and the white supremacist group, because some of those people were just there protesting white supremacism. But Antifa... the anti-fascist group, it's a distinct political movement.
It is.
It is not everyone who is anti-fascist.
Sure, but what has ended up happening online is that people are calling anti-fascists the people who were protesting against the white supremacist. And so that's what I'm
There might well have been Antifas in that group. But as I said,
I'm sure there are crazy people everywhere.
Yeah, but you know, Antifas are not very... It's not a very pleasant political ideology. And in many ways, it is just as authoritarian as the people they're protesting against. I mean, it's like these class...
But at least it doesn't want to lynch and kill people of colour.
It probably does want to lynch and kill, like, conservatives, though.
Yeah.
Which, you know, despite our previous comments about them...
Yeah.
Yeah, I probably managed to offend like the entire pantheon of political persuasions during the course of this podcast.
It's kind of our job, isn't it, though?
I hope so, yeah.
Yeah. I was kind of disappointed at how Western this was in terms of like its summary of
it's
the
a Western view, it's a Western
that.
Viewpoint, right?
It's not...
It makes no reference whatsoever to like Oriental political traditions and... all of those other things.
So the problem that I think that we have is that we are still, even if you're trying to interpret it through this postmodern, pre-modern, modern spectrum, there's still this spectrum that we are kind of tied to as a society that, well, we've tried quite a lot of them, from complete fascism to complete communism, and very few of them actually seem to work very well. The ones in the middle tend to be the ones that are working, like, okay, but still people get pissed off with them. At what point do we end up looking beyond this spectrum of ideas and trying to figure out something else? Maybe Confucianism?
Well, I guess I agree with the authors of this essay. There's one bit where they said, like... It's the way to actually create a good society is to mediate between individual and group interests and public and private interests through a variety of liberal democratic institutions. That's pretty mild. It doesn't look great on a placard, but it is. It's pretty much the best.
Stick that on a t-shirt and say...
Pretty much the best system. I mean, it's...
Oh my God, can we have that on a right dishonourable t-shirt?
Yeah, maybe we will do. It's that thing that Tim Marshall said, that is that extremes are easy in that... they are, you know, politically pure. You don't have to, like, think about caveats. You don't have to think about implementation necessarily. The middle is hard. And I do agree with him in that. I mean, I think the authors of this essay do have a point in as much as that is true. But, I mean, you raise the point of Confucianism. Arguably, like, the Chinese model, which... I'm treading out dangerously outside of my intellectual waters here, but
I'll hold your hand. It's fine.
The Chinese model of doing things is delivering massive benefits to Chinese people, like in terms of increased living standards and whatever.
So, the major ideology driving, I would argue, still driving Chinese communism is that of paternalism, Confucianism, and hierarchy.
Can you roughly define Confucianism? Because I'm not entirely clear.
Okay, so Confucianism is basically the idea of very strict societal roles that people have that then produce a positive outcome for the whole.
It's kind of like order, then.
Yeah. It's very, and you see that order from politics to business to family. And it's that idea of kind of like structure and hierarchy. that is championed.
The alternative to that in Chinese discourse is legalism, is that right?
Yes.
Which is more about meritocratic institutions and that sort of thing.
And so there is a blend of the two, but I would still argue that Confucianism is the dominant ideology that's pushing them.
As I said, massively outside of my waters on this, so not going to quibble. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I agree with their view that those institutions are in modernity, as they define it, is important, but I actually think the slight contradiction in their position, and this sort of gets to the heart of what I mean by when I say these people don't like democracy, is that, for instance, they list like human rights and liberal democracy as like two of the main pillars of the success of the Enlightenment. I agree with that, but obviously anyone who's thought about it would say those two things are actually slightly in tension with one another, in as much as human rights are non-negotiable by their very existence. These are things that can't be voted away.
Yeah.
And actually, this is almost a paradox. I agree with the vast majority of human rights. So there's probably like some marginal things which you could quibble, but they're not democratic. And actually, it's not obvious where the authority for those things comes from. Mm-hmm. Those things continue to exist because elite institutions continue to support them and continue to provide them in some shape or form.
But what happens when those elite institutions then get taken over by the far extremes at either end? So let's say the postmodernists or the premodernists, as they're explained in this essay.
Yeah, I mean,
because that's kind of what we see happening with Trump in the White House, and with like the momentum getting more and more sucked into the Labour Party.
Yeah, but I'd kind of put it another way, is that even if you think that to take sort of a narrow example, there's feminists who've argued that the burden of proof for kind of criminal sexual assault cases should be lowered to convict more rapists and more people who commit those sort of crimes. The burden of proof is deliberately very high because it's seen as such a bad thing in the Western tradition to send an innocent person to jail that it's actually worth letting 10 times the number of men walk free who are guilty of the crimes they're accused of.
But that is a judgment that's been made by men.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's also a judgment that you could actually put it. What happens if the majority of people say, yeah, actually, we do agree that the burden of proof is too high, and we want slightly more appetite for putting innocent people to jail just so that we can get more criminals.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, on whose authority do you say no to that? Just because, you know, elites, say judicial elites or political elites, say that we don't want that, where exactly does the authority come from? And, I mean, part of what happened during the Brexit vote, I know everything comes down back to Brexit for us.
What did we talk about before this fucking thing?
Part of the problem with the Brexit vote is that British politicians for decades and decades supported the EU. And you can argue that, you know, they were right to do so for various strategic reasons. But ultimately, particularly around the issue of immigration, the public and the politicians diverged.
Mm-hmm.
And you can say, well, politicians know best. You can take like the elitist view of things, and it is an elitist view, whether or not you think it's good or bad. And we should go with what they say.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, their authority, theoretically speaking, comes from the people. It comes from the voters.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the voters say one thing...
In our form of democracy, at the very least.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you could argue that authority ultimately rests with the crown in Britain, but in practice, it's difficult to argue. But yeah, I mean...
I don't know, I'm waiting for King Charles III.
I think the Republic will come pretty soon after that. But yeah, it kind of interests me that I don't really know what to do with it, because as I say, I largely agree with the modernity settlement that is described in this essay. But at the same time, if people by and large want things to change, on what grounds can you refuse them? I don't know.
Well, we got sufficiently deep. Jimmy, if they have any opinions on this godforsaken article, where can they find you on the internet?
At JDE Nichols.
And they can find me at Jazza John. Please do tweet at the podcast as well. It is still sentient. At Right Dishonor on Twitter. Also, leave us a bloody review. Thanks.
Well, you should probably plug your YouTube video.
Oh, thanks. So I just put out a video about... So I went to the United States And interviewed the National Rifle Association, the NRA, and some LGBT gun advocacy groups, trying to figure out why gun advocacy has increased amongst the LGBTQ plus community. I'm very happy with it. I did graphics. Please go and watch it. It's on Rhyming with Oranges, my YouTube channel. Love me.
He took many hours over the graphics.
So many hours please. For a disproportionate amount of gain.
Please reimburse him for his time with a watch.
Very funny. Shall we go now?
We shall.
Okay, bye!